Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the September edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Mark Peplow and James Mitchell Crowe. I'm Chris Smith. On the way, how the legacy of Chernobyl lives on.
A group of researchers are claiming that radioactive fallout from the Chernobyl disaster has actually impaired the mental development of Swedish children that were still in the womb at the time of the incident.
But is the evidence up to scratch? Well, we'll find out shortly. We'll also be hearing how banned substances like LSD might hold the key to new cures for common conditions.
When they took LSD or psilocybin, they didn't continue to have these exquisitely painful headaches that are sometimes called suicide headaches, because people will kill themselves, some of them, to escape the torture of this condition.
And do you know what's in your dinner? The chances are you may well have been consuming things that you hadn't planned to eat, because food fraud is big business.
Food fraud is an amazingly large problem worldwide. In terms of commodities such as fruit juices, it runs into hundreds of millions of pounds. In some smaller ingredients, used in smaller amounts but of very high value, it probably still runs into millions of pounds.
Plus, we'll be taking a look at Dave's question, which is, well, a hangover from last month.
Hi, this is Dave from Cambridge. Why does the hair of the dog work as a hangover cure?
Well, it's not a medical myth at all, and the answer might just surprise you. It's coming up later in the programme.
The Chemistry World Podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, world leaders in pharmaceuticals. For a career with AstraZeneca, look us up online at astrazeneca.com.
First this week, over 11 years since it happened, the legacy of Chernobyl lives on in babies that were in utero at the time, it seems, Mark.
Yeah, this is a really interesting study, actually. A group of researchers are claiming that radioactive fallout from the Chernobyl disaster has actually impaired the mental development of Swedish children that were still in the womb at the time of the incident. Now, the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded back in April 1986, and it sent a cloud of radioactive material drifting over Europe. Now, a group of economists, interestingly, at Columbia University, in collaboration with a researcher at Stockholm University, have now carried out an analysis of more than 500,000 Swedish children that were born between 1983 and 1988. And what they've found, they've looked at their academic achievement over that period, and they found that when you look at the children who were between 8 and 25 weeks old in the womb at the time that Chernobyl's fallout drifted over Sweden, you see a blip, a down blip in their academic performance.
Is this done on the basis of IQ or something like that?
Well, it's done on the basis of the fact that Sweden seems to have quite a rigorous educational system and records that they can actually look at their grades, and also whether they qualify for high school or not, because there's a qualification exam there. So what they found is that children born in this period, August to December in 1986, so just a few months after Chernobyl exploded, were 4% less likely to qualify for high school, and they had 5% lower grades on average compared with other children born at different times.
Have they any ideas as to why they're seeing this? It's not just a small blip, because that is quite a small difference, isn't it?
It is a small difference, and this is one of the many reasons why this is, I'm sure, going to be quite a controversial study. This is something that, like I said, they've pulled out of the statistics from looking at more than 500,000 children. The effects, of course, on development in the womb at this period, 8 to 25 weeks post-conception, is probably the most vulnerable period for a child's development. So any kind of effect on the mother, any kind of strain on their system, is potentially going to have an effect on the child. Now, one of the sources of controversy that I mentioned is the fact that, of course, these people are economists. They're very well used to dealing with statistics, which is how they've done this study. But normally when people look at the effects of Chernobyl, it's like radiation physicists and environmental monitoring people, things like that.
So what do those sort of parties think?
Well, we went back and talked to a variety of people that are well used to looking at these sorts of studies. And while, of course, this study doesn't prove cause and effect, it only proves an association between the timing of Chernobyl's fallout and the timing of these children's academic performance. On the whole, the reaction was that the statistical method they used looks sound, and in fact, another of the researchers we talked to, Jim Smith, who works at the University of Portsmouth, says that this study appears to have controlled for sort of factors of uncertainty quite well, and that they should now go on and do a similar analysis in neighbouring countries to really nail whether this has happened.
And another reason why you mustn't wear Russian underpants. the Chernobyl fallout. Now, James, some interesting work is also ongoing in terms of how we clean up our wastewater act, because we could be in trouble in the future.
That's right. Well, you might think that the water coming out of sewage plants would be pretty clean, but it's actually not as clean as it looks. Certain molecules, in particular drug molecules and pesticides, are passing through these treatment plants completely unscathed, and so over time they are accumulating in the water system.
Why aren't they being removed? Is there some particular chemical reason why they accumulate like this?
They are not being removed because they are resistant to breakdown. Some of them have unusual structures that are not necessarily found in nature, and so there's probably not that many organisms that would be able to break down that sort of structure.
So what are the consequences of something like this building up in the way you describe, and by how much have they gone up?
Well, certain compounds have gone up about 60 times over a 30-year period. So in surface water, about 30 years ago, these things were kind of at nanogram quantities per litre, and now they're up to microgram levels. And so if that trend continues, then we could have problems. And in particular, as pressure on water resources grows, we're going to have to recycle our wastewater a lot more.
I guess the key question is this actually likely to be a problem for human health, though? It's all very well to say, well, these chemicals have increased, but do we have any direct evidence that that is a problem?
The evidence at the moment is not clear, I don't think, on exactly what effect they might have, but the concern is that this will become a problem in the future. And so these researchers in Italy have been working out ways to try and tackle this problem and break down these molecules that are coming out of the wastewater using a combination of techniques. They found that these compounds are amazingly robust. They have to use a combination of a photocatalyst called titanium dioxide, ultraviolet light, and also microwave irradiation to be able to break these things down.
Is the answer just to break them down, or should we be encouraging people not to use them in the first place? I mean, surely that's got to be a better solution, doesn't it?
Well, some of these compounds are good, important drugs. For example, one of them is naproxen, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which is used in arthritis. Others are good insecticides and herbicides. So these compounds do have their important uses. It's just a case of, can we break them down once their use is finished?
Thanks, James. Now, from drugs in wastewater to drugs in trials and how safe they are, it's recently been found that the drug rosiglitazone, which is marketed as Avandia, may be triggering heart attacks in vulnerable patients. But why wasn't this picked up in trials? Well, Cliff Rosen thinks we need a rethink with more emphasis on patients than on biochemical measurements.
Rosiglitazone, which goes under the brand name Avandia, is a activator of PPAR gamma, which is a nuclear receptor, which when activated by drugs like Avandia, can stimulate glucose transport and also fat differentiation. In this particular instance, the major effects appear to be insulin-sensitive cells such as fat cells and muscle cells.
So they're good because they lower blood glucose
They lower blood sugar rather dramatically, and they don't do it by stimulating the pancreas, unlike some of the other drugs like insulin. These drugs actually sensitize the cells to insulin so that you are not adding more insulin to the system. You're just making whatever insulin is around more sensitive.
That sounds really good. So what went wrong?
I think what went wrong was the fact that when we test drugs for diabetes, the primary endpoint for all of our studies has always been lowering the blood sugar, which is measured by hemoglobin A1C. So when these new drugs were discovered, they were found to lower blood sugar and reduce the hemoglobin A1C much more so than some of the other drugs. So that prompted the FDA and the European Regulatory Agency and everything to jump on board and say, look, these drugs are relatively safe. The 6-month studies look reasonably good, and they clearly lower sugar, which is the main endpoint for diabetic management anyways.
So when did that silver lining turn cloudy then?
It turned cloudy 2 years into the evaluation after approval. The FDA and the European agency said, we want to do some post-marketing studies. And in the post-marketing studies, they said, there's something going on here. We don't really know what it is, but there seems to be more anginal attacks and maybe more heart attacks. This was really contrary to what everybody thought. They actually thought this drug was going to protect against heart disease.
So how did the trials miss that? Because when you trial a drug, you're supposed to look into things
That's
like
right.
these kind of adverse outcomes.
The sponsors chose patients that were not at high risk. So they were obese and insulin resistant, but they didn't have diabetes. So their risk of heart disease was low. So when these events occurred, they were relatively uncommon. So even with large numbers of people, if you have relatively small numbers of events, that signal is going to be difficult to detect.
So it's not really anyone's fault. The people that regulated...
No, I don't think it was anyone's fault, because theoretically and in the laboratory and cells, it looked like this drug could do a lot of great things. We still see papers now coming out that you treat cells with rosiglitazone and their vascular reactivity is less, and they don't migrate and they don't build plaque. And so you wonder, you say, gee, you know, this is a good drug.
But the worry is that this kind of thing is going to really put a spanner in the works of the pharmaceutical sector, because we're trying to encourage companies to develop new agents and make people better. But
that's right.
Then you end up with an adverse outcome like this, everyone flinches, and it becomes so uneconomically viable for companies to develop new products that then all you do is create new versions of beta blockers that don't do anything different than the ones we've had for years.
That's right. This is a big problem for industry, because what it means really is you can't just say hemoglobin A1C is a surrogate endpoint, it means better glucose control, that means better patient outcomes. That's what we've been operating under.
So what are we going to do? Are you going to completely advocate a rethink?
Well, we have to have a rethink, and we have to say, look, we need a minimum of 2 years, and we need a lot better safety data. One of the problems is that the data accumulated at all these sites where the studies are being done were not adjudicated, were not judged for some of these events. If a person had chest pain on the study, what was that chest pain? How do you code it? What happened to that patient? This was not developed in the original trials, and this is a real problem.
Well, obviously, Cliff, we've got to sort this out, but the fact is, who's going to pay for it? Because it's already costing drug companies. The average molecule that goes from test tube to patients costing $50 to $200 million in 10 years. So who's going to pay for this in terms of finances and time?
Right. If the FDA is underfunded and that we need more resources, which everybody in the United States is talking about for the FDA, it shouldn't go into post-marketing studies where we just collect data, but it should go into helping to do some of these phase 3 trials where safety is a huge issue.
So what you're saying is that the companies can focus on making the agents, and right, governments and politicians can focus on making sure they're safe?
Yeah.
Do you think that's likely to happen? Because the budget will be absolutely monumental.
No. I don't think it's likely to happen, but things are changing. Already this has had some impact, and people are rethinking. There's a letter coming out next week in New England Journal by the FDA. And they've already got one drug that has great efficacy for diabetes, but they're doing more phase 3 trials for safety, and this is what we should be doing. I think the emphasis, again, should be both efficacy and safety, with patient outcomes the final arbitrator.
Cliff Rosen, he's at the St. Joseph Hospital in Bangor, Maine. In a second, how penguins are fouling up the Antarctic, food fraud, and a psychedelic cure for headaches. But first, James, lead in paint. It's been big news recently, what with millions of toys being withdrawn from sales due to health fears. But why put lead in paint anyway?
Lead paint was a very popular paint in the first half of last century, before people realised just how toxic it was, because as well as giving a nice colour to the paint, it also had all sorts of other really quite nice properties.
Do you actually have to eat it to get poisoned by it? Is it okay as long as you leave it alone?
Well, eating it is a particularly bad thing to do, but you can also ingest it by breathing in the dust, for example. There's a lot of advice out there for people renovating old houses that might have had lead paint as to...
Apart from just making the paint look a nice colour, were there any other benefits of putting the lead in, which is why it became so popular?
Well, yes, there certainly were. White lead is very water insoluble, so it gives a really durable water resistant layer, and also lead carbonate neutralizes the acidic decomposition products of the oils that make up the paint. That makes the paint much more durable and long lasting, and it retains its kind of flexibility, so it prevents the paint from cracking for a long period.
So if we no longer can use lead, because it's obviously banned because it's so toxic, what have people substituted instead to get the same chemical effects?
The pigment that lead has been substituted with is titanium dioxide, which has the same kind of pigment effects, but it's incredibly safe. It's even used in things like food colouring, in sunscreen, so there's no toxic effects of that at all.
Obviously the ban isn't very well enforced worldwide, though, is it? Because we've seen millions of toys everywhere in Britain being withdrawn because they came from China and this paint had been used. So are some countries still using large amounts of lead paint? Presumably they are.
they shouldn't be, but it seems like they are. This particular case, Mattel, which is the world's biggest toy maker, has had to recall thousands of toys that were painted in China. This particular company used lead-based paint rather than the non-toxic paint that the company were supplied with. So certain factories in China are using it illegally, it would appear.
It's very worrying indeed. Also very worrying is the accumulation of nasty things in penguins, Mark. Tell us about this.
You'd normally think that the Antarctic was this pristine area of snow, but unfortunately it's not quite as pristine as it ought to be. You find molecules there called persistent organic pollutants, things like organochlorine pesticides and brominated flame retardants. Now, they're not all bad. I mean, brominated flame retardants, of course, are the thing that stops your sofa going up like a candle if you drop a fag end on it. But, of course, they shouldn't really be accumulating in the Antarctic. The latest research on this is actually looking at how these materials get distributed in the Antarctic, how they get there in the first place and what happens to them once they're there. Now, in the past, people have just assumed that these sort of volatile compounds have drifted there, if you like, through atmospheric transport. But quite recently, people came up with the idea that maybe they're being transported there by migratory birds.
Well, how much more concentrated are they in the Antarctic than one would expect by just looking at background levels elsewhere?
This is the thing. In the Antarctic, there's virtually nothing that can break them down at all out in the fields just outside the studio, for example. There's enough things that will slowly but surely erode these things away, if you like. There are bacteria that can break these things down slowly but surely. In the Antarctic, once they're there, they really do tend to stay there. That's where they're persistent organic pollutants. But this latest study by a group of researchers at the University of Antwerp in Belgium have basically looked at the role of penguins down in the Antarctic. Now, they're not migratory birds. They're down there for the duration, and hardy beasts they are too. So they were actually looking at colonies of penguins and seeing what effect they had on distributing these persistent organic pollutants. And what they found was that in these colonies, the penguins poo, and the carcasses of the penguins that die there are absolutely riddled with the stuff. They're finding concentrations 10 to 100 times, in many cases, greater than sort of other areas of the Antarctic.
So where are the penguins getting them?
Well, the penguins are getting them basically because they eat so many fish which have trace amounts of these chemicals, and these chemicals basically stay in the penguin system and accumulate and accumulate, and either through their poo or when through their carcasses when they die, they create these hot spots, if you like, of these persistent organic pollutants in the Antarctic.
Is there anything we can do to clean this up?
Well, that's a good question. All of these sorts of compounds are now pretty tightly controlled. They weren't 30 years ago. A variety of legislation that's come in, most recently something called REACH, which covers all of chemicals in Europe, has really cut down on the amount of these chemicals which are used, in some cases banned them altogether, because people had realised that there was these accumulation effects. So from one point of view, the answer is time. Over the course of 100 years, these things will disperse, and because we're not putting more of them into the system, if you like, and their levels should go down. In terms of active cleanup, I suspect that it's simply too remote and too cold to actually get down there and with shovel and bin bag to actually clean this stuff up.
Has anyone speculated about what the consequences could be of these accumulations secondary to the penguins?
The higher up the food chain you go, the more likely you are to see this sort of accumulation. There's a similar effect in the Arctic when you see polar bears, because they're right at the top of the food chain as the chief carnivores. They're eating all the other things which have eaten all the fish which contain the pollutants. So in some cases, certainly in the case of polar bears, it has been shown to ultimately have problems with the accumulation of these chemicals. It may be shortening their lifespan. We don't know if that's the case with the penguins, but one can imagine that if you do see these rising concentrations of these pollution hotspots around their colonies, it's probably not good news for them.
Pollution on an unprecedented scale. Thanks, Mark. And now food for thought, or at least this will certainly make you think next time you buy something to eat in a supermarket, especially if it's expensive. Here's Peter Berry-Ottaway.
Food fraud is an amazingly large problem worldwide. In terms of commodities such as fruit juices, it runs into hundreds of millions of pounds. In some smaller ingredients, or used in smaller amounts but of very high value, it probably still runs into millions of pounds collectively.
So it's a massive problem, not just in this country but internationally. So what sorts of things tend to be the targets of this kind of adulteration?
Most of the ingredients and foods are those which have high value. So things like fish oils, which we've been working on, some of the ingredients in the health food industry, such as aloe vera, have been the target of quite a bit of adulteration over the years. And we go right into the main commodities, such as the adulteration of rice with different and cheaper species, basmati rice, for example.
How do most of these cases of fraud come to light? How is it noticed in the first place that there's something fishy about your cod liver oil, let's say?
Well, the cod liver oil was quite fascinating because after we cracked the problem and worked out what they were doing, I had a off-the-record comment from somebody in one of the Dutch ministries of trade who said, "Ah, that explains a problem we thought was a computer problem. We had 300 tons of oil going into a refinery and appeared to be 500 tons coming out," which is the reverse of what one normally expects.
Well, how was it that you actually cracked that puzzle? How did you solve the problem?
We had suspicions for some time relayed to us from various companies. And it's a very competitive business, very high-value business. We had to be very careful how we went about it. It turned out that the people doing it were very clever. Fish oils, and cod liver oil in particular, has a particular fatty acid profile that sits high in certain fatty acids and low in others. And they had managed to just get these within the normal limits and ranges. We finally cracked it by finding a route in via the sterols. These are steroid alcohols, and they're found in both plants and animals. If you take a fish oil from a pure source, you'll find it's about 95% cholesterol, which is the same form of cholesterol as we have in humans, or similar form to have in humans. If you look at plant sterols, then there's a whole range of these, which you can identify by various technologies such as thin layer chromatography and HPLC, and these plant sterols shouldn't be in fish oils. However, we found that in some samples of the fish oil we were suspicious of, plant sterols were comprising up to 55%, which brought the cholesterol level down to about 45-50%. We then had to prove that the fish couldn't have consumed the plant sterols by other means and naturals, feeding on plankton, for example.
So how did you do that?
First of all, we had various ideas which we had to disprove. One was that in the trawler gutting of the fish, there might have been cutting into the gut itself, which would spill the plankton over the liver while it was being removed from the carcass. And this ended up with me having to fly to Tromsø in northern Norway and getting on the trawler, going up into way into the Arctic Circle to try and catch cod. And then we gutted them, took out the livers, and put them into sealed samples for expression of the oil when we got back to the Fish Research Institute.
So these people back, who are the manufacturers who are being fraudulent, they were cutting the cod liver oil with plant synthetic oils. This is presumably what this story is telling you.
Yes. It was the intermediaries who were doing it. And they were probably taking an awful lot of money out of it. In fact, at the end of the day, we found it was rapeseed oil. It was a very cheap plant oil. And as soon as we started publishing the fact we discovered this, the whole market cleaned up rather rapidly, which is what we tend to find.
Sort of domino effect.
Yeah.
But what about other things? Because that's one particular example. You mentioned quite a few. It seems like this is quite widespread.
Oh, yes. One that we did a lot of work on was aloe vera, which is a cactus plant which tends to grow in arid areas. Very expensive juice and gel, and it's used in a number of health food products. It's also used in some toiletries, shaving creams, because of its wound healing potential. At one point, about 9 or 10 years ago, we found probably a third of the aloe vera products in the market in Europe had a degree of adulteration.
Gosh, that's very high.
Incredibly high.
If you look at the Olympics, going back a number of years, you can see the effects of people doping and using drugs and things. Mm-hmm. Athletics has had to clean up its act, but that forced the people that were, let's say, a bit less willing to obey the rules to be even more cunning. So are we going to see now these food fraudsters becoming even more cunning, working out clever ways to deceive people like you?
I always find it a challenge because those who are doing it, those who don't want to get caught early on, are being very clever. They do analyse the chemistry of the products. They know how far they can go under normal techniques. what the limitations of the analysis are, and they make all the modifications so that it's very hard to actually prove it first time off. With the aloe vera, we were wallowing around for a while, not being able to prove it, and then a chemist in Germany got a breakthrough to use nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR, and that gave us a profile where we could read like an open book. It just showed us what was being added, how much was being added, and what it was displacing in the original product.
Do you find you struggle when you go to restaurants now and you find yourself taking samples home in plastic bags to make sure that you're not being sold up the garden path, and that really is the caviar you thought it was?
No, not at all, but one is always suspicious.
The Sherlock Holmes of food science, Peter Berry-Ottaway, talking food fraud. Well, fraud could well land you in trouble with the police, and so could dabbling in illegal drugs. But one man who does this entirely legally is Harvard's John Halpin, who's been looking at how drugs like ecstasy, MDMA, could have genuine clinical benefits.
There's many people who believe these substances have many potential uses: therapeutic, religious, introspective, recreational. A tremendous amount of work has to be done before we could ever claim that they are legitimate medicines. They're not approved by the FDA or, I believe, anywhere in the world as medicines, but that doesn't mean that the research shouldn't occur. What sort of things have been published of late? Well, there's a small study from University of Arizona about psilocybin being of use for people with treatment-refractory obsessive-compulsive disorder. There is ongoing studies of MDMA sold on the street as ecstasy at UCLA and down in South Carolina. In the former case for anxiety associated with end-stage cancer, in the latter with Dr. Michael Mithoffer, a study of treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. And then there's my work looking at MDMA, assisted psychotherapy for treatment of anxiety associated with advanced stage cancer. And I'm interested in continuing research on cluster headache, a severely debilitating, extremely painful condition that LSD and psilocybin may actually prove superior to approved medications. But there's a lot of ifs in that.
I'm just really surprised that we're beginning to look at these things again now, when most of the things you've just listed in that list of compounds have existed for a very long time.
MDMA, yes, was synthesized in the early 1900s from German Merck, but it was never synthesized with any stated purpose for medical use. The heyday of research was in the 1950s and 60s primarily, and I believe there's over 1,000 peer-reviewed papers, some 10 to 15,000 research subjects safely administered these substances, and then the legal system devised laws to make it more restrictive for the public to gain access to these substances. So in the United States, the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 and successive amendments in particular, in which LSD, psilocybin, marijuana, heroin, all these types of drugs were placed into Schedule I. And the debate in the United States and Congress specifically rotated, you know, around the issue of making sure to not prevent research. So Schedule I drug is legal for research purposes only. The world is not flat. If there might be some important medicinal property from a drug that, granted, that has a high abuse potential.
We'll take morphine as an example.
How about thalidomide? Sadly, England and the United States both have a lot of egg on their face from allowing that drug to be given to pregnant women, causing the most gruesome of birth defects. Yet, thalidomide is prescribable again in the United States because it really does help treat Hansen's disease, leprosy. And the company that manufactures this drug has a very unique patent on the distribution system. It's a generic drug, but the distribution system is set up to make sure that not one single woman of childbearing age or who is pregnant will get this drug.
So do you think that there are some hidden effects or potentials of drugs like ecstasy lurking out there, and we do need to be doing research in order to try and find out what they are?
Well, we won't know unless we do the research. If we have good results, hopefully the methodology that I published in the peer-reviewed literature is such that the skeptics or even colleagues in my field or in related fields will pick it up and replicate my work and find out on their own whether there truly is something useful in these medications. The ambition should be to work on something quite important and hopefully generate results that are genuinely compelling, for cluster headache, for example, which is probably the most painful condition that we know of, the current standard of care is we can give medications that have serious side effects, but that may prophylax a little bit so that they decrease the pain of the headache attacks somewhat. Or people with cluster headache have cluster periods in which they might have anywhere from 2 to 8 headaches a day or every other day for weeks to months. So if you have a triptan medication like Imitrex, it will stop the one headache that you have, but it won't stop the next one from occurring. The case series that we published last year in neurology of more than 50 individuals confirmed with cluster headache suggests that when they took LSD or psilocybin, it interrupted their cluster period so that they didn't continue to have these exquisitely painful headaches that are sometimes called suicide headaches because people will kill themselves, some of them, to escape the torture of this condition.
I wonder if that works because users hallucinate into thinking they're an aspirin, which then makes their headache better. That's John Halpin, who's tapping into the therapeutic potential of drugs of abuse. Finally this month, to Dave's question on why the hair of the dog, a stiff drink, can help to cure a hangover.
My name's Lee Cronin from the University of Glasgow, and I'm going to tell you why the hair of the dog works. When we drink wine and beer and spirits, these drinks normally contain alcohol, and the majority of that alcohol is ethanol. However, there is a very small percentage of methanol in these drinks, and the idea is that when you have an evening out or evening in, even you drink the alcohol, your liver will immediately start to process the alcohol and detoxify you, in effect. And what the liver does is there's an enzyme in the liver which is responsible and specific for removing ethanol. It's very specific for ethanol and does a very good job. However, when you go to bed, normally after drinking, and your liver gets through most of the ethanol, there's a very small percentage of methanol left, which is left in high concentration, and the liver is finished with the ethanol. So it then starts to work on the methanol, but unfortunately this produces an acid called formic acid, which is extremely bad for you and inflates your brain lining, dehydrates you, and causes a headache when you wake up. So when you wake up and you have your hangover, if you then drink some ethanol or some more alcohol, which is containing the majority of ethanol, your liver will stop processing the methanol because its enzyme is much more specific for ethanol. And then it will start producing ethanol rather than formic acid, and you feel a whole lot better, hence the hair of the dog.
So now you know, thanks to Lee Cronin for that answer. Here's next month's question.
Hello, this is Jan from Rayleigh in Essex. I'd like to know why spiders don't stick to their own webs.
So if you can help with that, please send your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you can also use that address if you'd like to send us some feedback. That's all for this month's Chemistry World podcast, which was produced and presented by me, Chris Smith, and Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com, with Chemistry World's editor, Mark Peplow, and science correspondent James Mitchell Crowe. We're back next month. Until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, world leaders in pharmaceuticals. For a career with AstraZeneca, look us up online at astrazeneca.com.